magazine. It's excuse me. It's primarily directed to baseball card collectors and things like that. But they have other features. They have stories about players or interviews and things like that occasionally. And I do some of that work.
Yeah, well, I've done some of those from time to time. People, you know, would call me and they used to have enough. They still do those smaller little magazines.
Yeah, there's a few of them around. I think there's probably three or four. Some are monthly and some are bi-monthly, things like that. And you were, I guess, a rarity in your day. It's pretty common now, but you finished college before you started playing professionally.
Yes.
Did you play both baseball and basketball in college?
Yes, both of them.
At Ohio University?
Mm-hmm.
This is not part of the interview. I have a son that's 18 years old, a senior in high school now. He's been accepted by Ohio University. He's not sure he's going there.
Oh, are you?
He wants
where
to...
Where are you calling me from?
Paris, Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
He wants to... he's a pitcher on the baseball team. He wants to play baseball there, but they haven't offered him a scholarship yet, and some of the others have, but he might be there. You played 1 year after college, and then you went in the Navy. Did you enlist?
Before graduation exercises, school was out my senior year. I was signed by the Cincinnati Reds by Frank Lane. And they sent me to Riverside, California, with the Riverside Reds. After about 6 weeks or so, I think the league folded up. And I was sent to Ogden, Utah in the Pioneer League, and I finished the season there. And in those days, the minor leagues season ended on Labor Day. And I got on the Greyhound bus and came to Cleveland, where my college sweetheart lived. And from here, I got on another bus and went down to Midvale, Ohio, where I was born and raised, and told my mom and dad that I was enlisting in the Navy.
And you are...
I enlisted in the Navy to get my 1 year conscription out of the way.
Well, they got you five times over.
Well, you know, during the period while I was playing ball that summer, the services were building up, and I'd gotten a few letters from a Commander Cook at Great Lakes Naval Station, you know, talking about the qualities of Great Lakes Naval Training Station, et cetera, and what they were going to do, and if I was going to go into service, that I should look at them.
Did you play for the Great Lakes ball team while you were there?
I played basketball on their basketball team, and I played on their baseball team, both of them. Yeah.
And you played for the whole time? Were you there the whole time, or did you go overseas?
I played... when I enlisted in the Navy, I got up to Great Lakes the end of September, and they'd already started their basketball practice, so I got into that, and then in the spring, the baseball season ended, and in the meantime, while I was there, one of the officers told me to apply for an ensign's commission, which I did, and I played on the baseball team, and about two-thirds of the way the baseball season, I was sent to submarine training school, but I didn't go into that.
Did you stay at Great Lakes, or were you transferred?
Well, I stayed at Great Lakes until my commission. Until my commission came through. It was, if I remember right now, it was the latter part of the baseball season. Played basketball. during the winter, and then in the spring and most of the summer played on the baseball team, and my commission came through, and that's when they sent me to Treasure Island out on the West Coast, and I was on, remember the old cowboy movie star, Johnny Mac Brown?
Oh, sure.
He was commander of the destroyer. I was at Treasure Island, and they sent me out on the destroyer to learn the mechanics of being an officer, et cetera.
How long were you at sea?
Well, that was just out there, and then I got transferred I'm getting ahead of myself. the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor when? December 2nd of what year?
41.
Right, okay. So while I was playing basketball at Great Lakes, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. You know, and that's when things started getting exciting.
It does.
I had forgot about any 1 year of conscription, and then in the spring I started playing on the baseball team and played over half of the summer, and that's when my commission came through and I was sent out to the West Coast to Treasure Island to learn basically the mechanics of how to be an officer. And then they put me on Johnny Mac Brown's destroyer for training, you know, at sea.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was out there, I got my orders to report to Brooklyn Navy Yards. I was assigned to a ship, because we were in the war full scale now. And I spent almost 5 years in the service. I was in the Atlantic, North Atlantic, the Mediterranean, and I was in the Pacific.
So you didn't get to play ball toward the end?
Not after the first basketball season, and after three-fourths of the baseball season.
Well, you came out, you evidently hadn't lost too much because you started playing professionally in both of them again.
Well, I came back. I was in Cleveland when the war ended, and I found out that I had more than enough points to get out after the second bomb was dropped and all that. They wanted me to take a group of ships to Japan. You know, as you know that. We sent a lot of people over to Japan after the war ended, but I found out that I had an overabundance of points to get out, so I decided I'd get out of the service. So after I got home, I got a call from Youngstown, Ohio, and was the basketball coach of the Youngstown Bears, who were in the old National Pro League.
Mm-hmm.
They had teams like Oshkosh and Sheboygan, Fort Wayne, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Holman Transfers, and Youngstown Bears. I think Syracuse and Rochester were in that, too. And so I played basketball with the Youngstown Bears that winter. And during the winter, I wrote a letter to Warren Giles, who was the general manager of the Reds. And I asked him what my status was in regards to the Cincinnati Reds. And he said, you are the property of the Cincinnati Reds, and you are to report to spring training at such and such a time, which was near the end of February in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So I played four-fifths of the basketball season. In those days, they'd already started playing about 60, 70 games a year, you know.
Right.
And I went to spring training, and League where I played the rest of the year.
Well, you tore them up down there.
then I played basketball with the Cleveland Rebels in the first year of the NBA, which was called the Basketball Association of America.
You were All League, weren't you?
Hmm?
You were named for the All League team, weren't you?
Yeah, the all 12 team or 10 team, whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
So was I named to the all league team in the old National Pro League.
Why did you choose baseball over basketball?
Well, I would say when I came up to the Reds in 47, I felt that I was going to be there on a regular basis. During the latter part of the summer, the guy who owned the Cleveland Rebels sold the franchise to the Providence, Rhode Island. And after being away in the war all that time and then playing sports all this time, being away from home, I got the feeling that maybe things had to change.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a fairly decent year in 47, so Warren Giles called me in the office for the season and gave me a check, and so I said, check, and asked me not to play basketball that winter, and I looked at the check and I said, well, you just talked me into not playing. So after not playing basketball that winter, I decided to stay with baseball as long as I could.
Well, you had an awfully good rookie year. It was a good year for rookies. We had Robinson and Jansen in the league too, but you had an awfully good year. You had an awfully good second year, but your third year, what happened?
Well, a lot of things happened. The managerial changes, conflict of personalities, I guess.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
Basically on my part. But everything just didn't go well. Even when Hank Sauer and I were sold middle of the year to the Chicago Cubs for Peanuts Lowry and Harry Walker.
Uh-huh.
I went over to the Cubs and for some reason or another, I wasn't in Frisch's plans, who was the manager then. And consequently, I was left on the outside looking in.
Was your age a problem? You were not a young rookie when you first got up.
No, I went 4 years in college and spent almost 5 years in the war, so you're talking about 9 years. I was, what, 27?
Yeah, you were 27 in your rookie year, right?
Right.
It wasn't looked down upon as much back then as it is today, but a 27-year-old rookie, they act like he's got leprosy or something today.
Well, you see, in those days, I always thought that I would play professional baseball somewhere. But going to college 4 years and then being 5 years in the service, that takes a lot of years off of your...
That's a whole career for some guys.
Right. Takes a lot of longevity away from you.
They sent you out to the coast, and you had a fantastic season out there for the Angels.
Yeah, and he still didn't want to bring me back from all the stuff that I heard from friends of mine. But the next year, he just said he couldn't keep me off the team.
No, you had a very good year following that up, and then the year after that, you were right there for the batting title up to the last little bit.
Yeah, and he couldn't do anything about that, but he tried.
It's a shame personalities have to enter into these things, but they do, I guess it's unavoidable.
I never had any problems with anything. It was just something that was unavoidable. I guess maybe it was people being having a jealousy or something because Hank Sauer and I were such good friends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've tried to throughout all the years wonder what happened. One of the managers used to say to me, called me in his office and said, look at all these lineup cards that I've made out. And I, from that day on, I knew there was something wrong with him, not me. I said, yeah, I see them all, but I says, I don't see my name on there. And the names I'm looking at can't play as well as I can.
Well, you were consistently, you consistently hit for a high average. There were higher averages in the league each year, but you were consistently probably in the top 20 or 25 batters in the National League year in and year out.
I did all right. I had close to 291 lifetime batting average.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's.
I was almost 39 years old when I quit.
Yeah, and you were still swinging the bat.
I think I might have tried it. Well, if I hadn't done the bad case of muscle spasms and wound up in the hospital and then had to quit, I would have probably stayed in baseball in some capacity. A good friend of mine, Gay Paul, always tried to get me to stay in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere.
So you didn't stay on as a coach or anything? You left it entirely?
No, I just left it entirely.
It's kind of hard to do after you're in for so long, isn't it?
Yeah, but I did it because my kids were starting to grow up, and I wanted to watch them do their thing.
Well, you've got to have priorities, that's for certain. What do you remember about the batting race you had with Musial?
Well, when you see the ball and it looks like a balloon, and practically everything is thrown, you hit, and everything goes well. You remember a lot of things. The greatest thing that I remember is what a super guy Musial is.
He is
and probably always will be. I hope he's all right now. I think he had a prostate cancer operation.
Yeah, just before the end of the year, I believe it was.
Yeah, I saw him in St. Petersburg at a distance. I didn't get the chance to talk to him. He had come out of the governor's dinner there in St. Pete when the Major League alumni were down there, and somebody wrestled him in a cab, and I waved to him as they went in a car, and I waved to him as they went by. I'm sure he recognized me.
Oh, you guys played against each other a long time.
Yeah, and the thing about that year was the fact that I became the only major league ball player that ever batted against Stan Musial.
Oh, yeah? That was the time you pitched?
I was the only guy he ever pitched to in the big league. He threw one pitch, and I took one swing right-handed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What'd you do with it?
Well, the Cardinals and us were both in the second division that year, and we played the last game of the season in St. Louis, and we went down there on a Sunday. We went down there overnight on a train from Chicago, and none of us knew that Eddie Stanky had worked up a deal with the press and everything that Musial was going to pitch to me the next day, and I was the leadoff hitter for the Cubs. As it turned out, Harvey Haddix was their pitcher. Musial was playing center field, and Sally Hemus was the third baseman. And when time to play ball, Stanky ran out of the dugout and called time and brought in Musial to warm up. And Phil Cavaretto was my manager, and he came out to the plate. He says, "It looks like they're trying to make a fool out of you, Frank." And I says, "I don't think so." He says, "Well, it looks to me like Stan Musial's going to pitch to you." I said, "Well, if he pitches to me, I'm going to bat right-handed." And he says, "Did you ever bat right in before?" I says, "No." I says, "I never swung a bat right in my life." He said, if you don't have bat right-handed, you don't have a gut in your body. Well, I did. He threw one pitch, and I hit the dog shit out of the ball. I hit a line, low line drive that hit Sally Hemus on the right shin on the inside and rolled down in the left field corner, and I was on second base, and they flashed an error on the board.
Oh, boy.
And then Stanky came out and had Musa go back to center field, brought Haddix back in to pitch. And at the end of the inning, he called the press box and said, I never saw a base hit in my life. That was it. But he had three hits that it didn't make any difference. I could have never beaten him in, or really wanted to beat him in a batting championship race.
Well, he beat you by like 8 or 10 points, something like that?
Yeah. He was a super ball player.
Yes, he was.
Super guy, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's what I remember about the 52 season. I had a good year the year after that.
Well, you had a good year. Yeah, you had 306 the next year, was it?
Yeah.
And you were right at the next year, you were right under 300, I believe, 295 or 298, something like that. You had a...
I was pleased with the way I played.
anybody that wouldn't be pleased with the 290 career batting average has got a problem. You had a heck of a job there in Chicago for a couple of years. You played between Kiner and Sauer.
Well, that wasn't really that bad. I tell you what, it was a thing that Garagiola, you know, when he was announcing baseball.
Uh-huh.
About once a month, he would bring that up, and it kept my name alive throughout all the years.
Yeah, I believe I heard him say that.
And the other guys, some of the other guys picked it up, like Ernie Johnson picked it up when he was announcing, and somebody else did. Yeah. But what was that one that he, Garagio, said, he says, I'd look out there and left field and see Ralph Kiner practicing his batting stance. And he says, then I'd look over in right field and there's old big Hank Sauer with a big chaw of tobacco in his mouth just swishing it around. He says, I look over in center field and there's Frankie Baumholtz taking oxygen.
It could be some truth to that. I think both those guys were underrated. I don't think they were good fielders, but I think they were underrated.
I don't know what kind of a fielder Kiner was. I think when Kiner came to the Cubs, he already had bad legs. And I knew that he couldn't sleep very well at night, so something, his legs or something was bothering him, but he could hit.
Yeah.
And they couldn't put him in right field, so Hank Sauer was actually a very good left fielder.
Mm-hmm.
So they put him in right field and put him out of position. So that's where all the problems was. No, but it was turned out to be a fun thing. It was a good thing for me because it brought me a lot of publicity throughout the years after I was out of baseball.
I admit it did.
And I enjoy every bit of it. I still do today.
Well, as long as Garagiola's around, he'll be telling his tales.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story about Hank Sauer. I was a long time ago. I was a pitcher when I was a kid, and I had a little bit of ability. I don't have enough, but I was invited up to Seal Stadium. First year the Giants were out there, and for the pitching coach to look at me. And I went in, and he gave me a uniform, and it was Bill Posedale. Gave me a uniform, said, get it on, going out in the field. And I was so nervous, and nobody spoke to me. Posedale told me to take the uniform and go out in the field. Nobody else spoke to me. I mean, everybody around, you know, walked by me, bumped into me, didn't say anything. And so I just, you know, left the dressing room, went on up there. A few minutes later, Hank Sauer came up, walked up to me, said, would you like to throw? And it helped me relax. He was very nice. He tried to make conversation. I was not doing much talking back because I was still so nervous. But he was just a really nice guy. Well, just you know, I don't know if he was that nice all the time, but he sure did make me feel good.
He's a very dear friend of mine.
He's still with the Giants, isn't he?
Yeah, he's still with them. He lives out just a little south of San Francisco in a little city called Millbrae, California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we live right down the, we lived in Palo Alto, which is right down below Millbrae.
Yeah, he works there, Phoenix Camp and all that other stuff. Yeah, he's getting up in the years. He's a couple years older than I am.
Yeah, he was around a long time. He didn't spend as much time with Uncle Sam, but he was started up at the same time you did, I believe.
Yeah, I think he started, he played at Syracuse in one of the Reds AAA farm club, and then he played with them, I think, in 45 or 46, somewhere there, yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking his record up right now. He was in the Coast Guard 2 years, came up at the end of, middle of 45,
uh-huh.
And then came up to stay in 48.
In 48?
Yeah, then he was sent back down, 46 and 47, he was in Syracuse, came back up in 48.
Oh, okay.
And started hitting a bunch of home runs. He's about 6 months older than you are. I would have thought he was older than that. You were an outstanding pinch hitter. You had a 307 career batting average as a pinch hitter. You led the league in pinch hits twice. Why were you so good? Yeah, you did. You led in 1955. You had 15 pinch hits with the Cubs, and then 56 with the Phillies, you had 14, and that led the league both years.
I'll be darned, I didn't realize that.
Yep.
Well, thanks for telling me.
You learn something new every day.
Yeah.
Smokey
Burgess was the greatest pinch hitter.
Well, he did not have he had more pinch hits because he pinch hit more often. You have a higher average than Burgess. Oh. You were 7 for 15 in 1948,
mm-hmm.
and 6 for 20. In 1949, and in the early 50s with the Cubs, you didn't pinch hit much, but you had four outstanding years as a pinch hitter.
Oh, we did.
And you 16 point higher pinch hitting average than you had as a regular average.
Oh. Well, anyway, that pleases me to know that, too.
If you go on the average of, let's say you batted how many times? 153 times, 153 at-bats as a pinch hitter. When you take the averages, batting averages of pinch hitters over the years, you're in the top six or eight.
No kidding.
Yeah, you're right up there. You didn't have as many opportunities as some guys. But you were right up there.
Oh.
What was there a game other than batting against Stan Musial? Was there a game in your career that stands out?
Well, I got to tell you, in the beginning, when kids would send you requests for autographs and they'd send notes and ask you to tell them what your greatest thrills were in baseball, and I used to think in the beginning, not knowing, not thinking things out close enough, I used to say, one of my greatest thrills was, my first big league game in Cincinnati, batting against Howie Paulette, and getting two hits off of him.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
that's a pretty good left-hander, and you were left-handed better.
At that time.
Yeah.
And then I started changing, revising my wording, and one day it dawned on me what my greatest thrills were in my Major League Baseball career was the fact that I played in the era where I felt the greatest Major League ball players played or ever would play again, and throughout the years it's proved to be the truth.
I think that's right, yeah. There's just more good players in your day.
Middle 40s through the middle 50s, overall played the against every team had talent galore.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't diluted with extra teams and extra players like it is now. Well, who was the best, best one hitter you saw? Was that Musial?
Well, I used to like to watch Ted Williams. I think Ted Williams was probably, as far as a hitter, was probably the greatest hitter, but I think Musial, from my playing against him, was a great, great hitter. Well, right at the top. It just so happens that in those days they were super ball players.
Oh, they sure were.
You know, you got Willie Mays and you got, well, of course, DiMaggio. I think that Joe DiMaggio was the greatest all-around player.
That was my next question.
I think. But for a five-year period, the greatest player that I think that I played against, I'm not saying, you know, he was greatest home run hitter, greatest hitter, but the greatest player who could do the most things to hurt you was Jackie Robinson.
Yes, for 5 years?
For a five-year period.
Yeah. What about Ernie Banks came there when...
Ernie Banks is a tremendous guy, and he was... a good friend of mine, plus Hank